Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, loads to talk about today because Madrid is well and truly underway. Of course it is. In fact, it's about 3 days underway on the women's side. The men's just about rolled into town and they're about to start playing. In fact, they had a few matches today. Matt Roberts is here alongside me, David Law, virtually. Catherine Whittaker is in Madrid. We'll be hearing from her in a little while. We've obviously got the very sad news about Boris Becker's downfall, I suppose you could say. He's been jailed for 2.5 years, of which half of that's going to be spent in jail because of his failure to keep to all the rules of his bankruptcy. And that's a pretty disturbing tale, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the podcast. But Matt, how are you doing? You all right?
Very well, thank you, David. Back from my golf trip and ready to tune back into tennis.
How did it go? Did you fare better than when you played against me, albeit you did win?
I think I did play better, yes, and it was very enjoyable. I don't know whether this is a blasphemous thing to say on a tennis podcast, but I think golf might be my favourite sport to play.
What? You're cheating on tennis?
It's purely personal. I think I'm better at being kind to myself with golf because I have far lower expectations. I've actually been playing tennis quite a lot of my life, and I feel like I should be better than I am. But with golf, I don't feel that at all. I've probably played, I don't know, fewer than 50 rounds of golf. So if I make mistakes, it doesn't bother me quite so much. Yeah, I enjoyed it, and I did make mistakes.
Okay. All right. Well, if you are a recent listener to the Tennis Podcast, folks, Matt has thrashed me at golf. He's also thrashed me at tennis. So I'm searching for a sport at which I can beat him at. And he has not yet taken my challenge of a pool match because I'm quite good at pool. So anyway, let's talk about tennis and Madrid, which is well and truly underway. Before Matt and I start getting tucked into it all, let's hear from Catherine Whittaker, who is in Madrid for Amazon Prime Video presenting their coverage, and she was courtside today. I was watching the coverage throughout the day, an amazing spot that Catherine and Annabelle Croft have got, and Daniela Hantikova's over there as well, literally on the court while the players are knocking up. It's quite a sight. So hello, Catherine.
Hello, team and listeners. Greetings from Madrid, where it's been quite a day for me. Day one for me of presenting from on site. Obviously, the tournament's been going for several days. It's really exceeded my expectations, actually. I've been to this tournament before in a different role, but not for several years. And barring, you know, the odd match here and there, mostly involving Rafael Nadal or... I suppose pretty much Nadal, or, you know, perhaps the odd really electrifying match. I found the atmosphere quite often to be a bit flat here, but that's really not been the case so far in my experience. It's been really, really electric, the atmosphere. Okay, I've only been here at a weekend, so we'll see what it's like tomorrow, but it's felt really vibrant and intense. And it really feels like, you know, it's such a sporting city, Madrid, isn't it? It feels like, you know, the tennis fans are back in force post-pandemic restrictions. So that's been really enjoyable. The tennis has largely been good quality. I mean, a couple of big matches have disappointed. I mean, Andreescu Collins, I thought, would be ding-dong this morning, and Andreescu just steamrolled her. So the match is disappointment, but it's brilliant to see Andreescu back. It's fascinating seeing the conditions up close. The altitude really does reward aggression. So it can lead to some really brilliant swashbuckling tennis, or it can lead to some really erratic tennis where it just sort of pings off the racket. And the player looks like they've got no control. So it's a mixed bag, but I loved seeing Raducanu play like she did today. I mean, she was just full of joy and sparkle. Made me think of that Suzanne Longland quote about there must be some sparkle too. And yeah, I don't know, you know, if she's going to win the thing, but it looks like US Open Emma Raducanu to me, and that's an absolute joy. I'm quite excited about this tournament. Actually, I'm keen to find out who the best of the rest is without Iga Świątek here, and I'm pumped for Andy Murray against Dominic Thiem tomorrow night in very much soon to be out of date tennis news. And you know, Alcaraz playing in front of home fans with all the expectation, and maybe he'll play Nadal again like he did on his 18th birthday here last year and got walloped. Anyway, that's all either soon to be out of date or soon to just not happen. So I'll wrap this up and I'll go and eat my croquetas, which are very much one of my favourite things about this country and this city. So thanks for holding the fort in my absence. And I don't know why I'm volunteering this prediction, but I think Halep might win it. That's my early feeling. Feel free to edit that out. And yeah, I think probably should be a wrap from me. Bye.
Catherine with a big prediction, Matt, at the end. Simona Halep for the title. What do you think?
Absolutely not editing that out. Holding Catherine to it. I like it. I like the pick, and I'm pretty sure that has come from watching Halep against Paula Badosa in particular. That was an eye-catching scoreline. It was an eye-catching performance from Halep beating Badosa so easily. And I think both Catherine and I commented while we were watching that on Halep's intensity. Right from the start, right. She just seemed really engaged in the match. She broke Badosa straight away and then kept it up the entire match. I've watched Halep in the past, and she's one of my favourite players to watch. She's an incredible player, but sometimes she can let an opponent back into a match, or she can wander, she can let things bother her sometimes, and that's all part of what makes her so engaging to watch, I think. But she was just ruthless and really hitting the ball aggressively, hitting it flat. That's something that she says she's been working on with Patrick Mouratoglou, who's obviously there coaching her now. And I think when you hire Patrick Mouratoglou as a coach, you know, you sort of get Mouratoglou-fied. You sort of take on a whole sponsor. Suddenly her box, all these M's are appearing on people's hats. And it's like it's like a brand that you sign up to, isn't it? But he is a good coach, I think. He must be, given the players he's worked with and the setup he's got there. And it sounds like that was a real focus of their few weeks practice together leading up to this, to be more aggressive, to win matches more efficiently, because her body's been breaking down on her recently in the last couple of years. And if that performance was anything to go by, that's a really positive start to that partnership, because I thought she was awesome. And she's got pedigree in Madrid as well. I think 4-time finalist, 2-time winner. So yeah, I can see why Catherine's gone with that pick.
I turned that match on and it was already a set and a break up for Halep. And I think moments later, Badosa started to have a bit of treatment just courtside by the physio. And I said to you guys, is that injury the reason for that scoreline? Because that scoreline is not what I was expecting at all. You know, Badosa's in her home country. The crowd are going for her. They're trying to latch onto any little opportunity to get behind her. She's been in great form. She always feels like the almost perfect clay court player, although I have to say Halep, I think, is also worthy of that description. And, of course, she's won the French Open as well and all those clay court finals you mentioned in Madrid. But it was so one-sided, I couldn't really believe that a fully fit Badosa would be getting this sort of drubbing, to be honest. And to be fair to her, she just came out at the end of the match and she said, I can't blame my physical condition at all. She was perfect, basically pointing over at Halep. She was perfect. And that's very interesting because I do tend to think of Halep as a player who has a very, very high level, but that there's probably a ceiling to which she can dominate an opponent. I never think she's going to have the weight of shot to be able to truly knock somebody off the court, for instance. But, yeah, she got the job done handily.
Yeah, I would think probably the last time Halep played a match which would jump out to me as perfect was probably the best match she ever played, which was that Wimbledon final against Serena Williams when Patrick Mouratoglou would have been in the other corner, wouldn't he? He would have witnessed that performance. And I mean, Halep was perfect that day, wasn't it? Obviously very different conditions on grass, but I remember she barely made an unforced error in that match. And against Badosa, she was not making unforced errors. She was hitting winners. Yeah, it was a great, great performance. And I always say it, but I think tournaments are better when Simona Halep's in them because she makes good matches. Mm. And I hope we're going to see much more of her on the clay this season.
Does remain intriguing, doesn't it, in terms of what this means for Serena Williams, the fact that Mouratoglou is no longer effectively coaching her. And, yeah, I want to know where that's going to end up. It hasn't taken Mouratoglou long to get involved in Twitter conversation, and he's actually suggested to his followers that they might want to come up with a team name for himself and Simona Halep. I don't quite know what he has in mind, but I've got a good suggestion, and that's Simona Halep. Might be a good team name. So anyway, who else have we seen today, Matt? I quite enjoyed watching Bianca Andreescu start the day. Catherine was referencing her. And, you know, talking about one-sided scorelines that you don't expect to come up, I did not expect 6-1, 6-1 to be the scoreline that she would beat Danielle Collins, who looked off the pace. I think she had some injury problems and she's not had so many results of late. But she just looked so uncomfortable out there. And Andreescu, by contrast, looked like the Andreescu of... it sounds ridiculous saying about a 21-year-old, the Andreescu of old. But, you know, she looked like 3 years ago, Andreescu.
It was her first top 10 win since that US Open final in 2019. And I mean, 2019 in many ways feels like a different world, doesn't it? But particularly when you think of Bianca Andreescu. And I think she said this was her best performance of her comeback so far. Obviously started in Stuttgart and now continued into Madrid. Yeah, she looked great. She looked really good. She looks fit and healthy, which is the most, you know, one of the most important things. And the game looks good. And I think it was something like only her 8th tour level match on clay or something. You know, I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk about Emma Raducanu in great detail very soon, and she's obviously playing and taking first steps on clay at the moment. But Andreescu, okay, maybe not taking quite her first steps on the surface, but still kind of baby steps, you know, in terms of her career generally. And yet she looks pretty at ease on this surface. She told Catherine on the podcast a couple of weeks ago how much she loves clay and how much it suits her game. And yeah, again, just someone we haven't seen playing tennis like this on this surface makes it extremely exciting, I think. Yeah, I was impressed with her.
Particularly when you think of the blow that tennis took a few weeks ago with Ash Barty announcing her retirement and Iga Świątek pulling out of this tournament to save herself really for Rome and Paris to come. I think good, sensible decisions. But to see the draw still so full of fascinating, interesting, stars, really, in Andreescu, because that's what she is, and that's what some of the other players we've seen today make you feel like they are. That's the perfect example of the strength of women's tennis, but also the appeal of Andreescu, that I'd almost forgotten about her because it's gone so long without her being there. But today was just a reminder of what she's got.
Yeah, it was. I think she was on first, wasn't she? She was on at about 11 o'clock in the morning, local time. And
she didn't make it look like that. You know, usually it's a pretty flat performance and somebody wins, you know, and then you forget all about it. But she just immediately looked like she'd been up for about 5 hours, you know, as though she's a real early morning person. She was just on it.
Yeah, it was an incredible injection of life into the order of play straight away. And yeah, I mean, talking about the draw more generally, I think Ons Jabeur is the only top 10 seed remaining. You know, we've lost so many big names over the last few days, you know, as the sort of start of this tournament has crept up on us midweek. You know, the defending champion Sabalenka's gone, the two home favourites Muguruza and Badosa's gone, as you said, Iga Świątek's not here, Sakkari's out, we'll talk about that, we'll talk about Osaka going out, but you know, we've still got so many names which are big names or have pedigree on clay or have pedigree in this tournament. You know, just looking at them, Anisimova, Halep, Bencic, Raducanu, Rybakina, Andreescu, Pegula, Goff, Azarenka. I mean, these are massive names still, and they're all still there.
It's great.
And it's great. As you said, it's strength in depth. That's what it is.
Mm. Let's have a chat about Raducanu, because I did see her match last week on clay, indoors, different type of conditions altogether in Stuttgart against Iga Świątek, and I thought she played really well. And she lost 6-4, 6-4, but she broke her serve at one point. She was pushing her hard in a lot of the games, and I enjoyed watching clay court Emma Raducanu play in that match. But I did wonder how she would back it up. I wondered whether the decision to separate with Torben Belts, which was announced following that match, whether that would have any effect on her at all in a negative sense. I mean, it's very interesting listening to Catherine's assessment of her and how that Martinsova victory impressed her so much. And today she absolutely thrashed Marta Kostyuk. A couple of games she lost in the match. And from ball one, there was just confidence. There was just authority about the way she hits the ball. And you know, we'll talk a little bit later about Naomi Osaka, but the difference in movement on the surface, the kind of look of a player who's at ease and comfortable and decided she's going to slide and is enjoying the process of sliding into shots and into corners and out of them again. She looks like she's got time on the ball, Raducanu. She doesn't look rushed at all. Really, there's only Świątek that so far that I've seen her on the surface able to rush her, and I think she could rush anybody on the planet. But she's such an interesting player to watch on all the surfaces. I mean, a really funny interview she gave ahead of this one, and Simon Briggs reported on it in the Telegraph as about how 365 days ago she was doing what maths paper 3 or whatever in her exams, you know, and she was barely playing any tournament. She was losing in British tour events and stuff like that, and here she is getting talked about as though her results are underwhelming because she's not winning them all in big tour events that she's never even played before. And look, I understand that she's the US Open champion. It is the absurdity of that gets lost for an awful lot of people, and I think that's kind of understandable that, you know, 10 or 11 million people watched that final here in the UK, and they then follow that and think, oh, how come she's losing now? What's wrong with her? You know, because they don't follow tennis all the time. And but I just find her so interesting. I find her approach to it all so interesting. And I know her, it's not just her. Her father's involved in the decisions over coaches and all that sort of thing is what I understand. But I just find Raducanu's general approach to tennis is she's a bit of a disruptor to what's convention. And the assumption is that there's something wrong with that from the establishment, I think. I've even been contacted by a couple of coaches over the last week saying she's changing coaches too many times, and they don't like this stuff. And I understand why. I mean, from a coach's perspective, it's a bit of a difficult gig to take, really, because there's no real long-term prospects in it. If you want a job, you're probably going to be out of it in a few months' time, the way it's approached. But from her perspective, seems to be laying down a kind of platform that she doesn't need what everybody thinks you need in your tennis careers. She seems to be able to work it out herself in her own way. I mean, and I say, well, good luck to you. If you can do it, go do it. There's no rule that says you have to have a coach and you have to employ them all the time. Yes, maybe you need to be upfront with them about that, but it's up to these people whether they take the jobs.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I'm going to be honest. I think I found out the news from you, David, via WhatsApp that Emma Raducanu had split with Torben Belts, and my reaction immediately was probably a negative one. It was probably like, oh,
same here. I like Torben Belts. I don't know him personally, but I like the way he comes across. They just had good results. And a bit like with Andrew Richardson, you do end up thinking, well, why would you ditch him? What's wrong? But I end up coming around.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the reason it's a negative one is, as you said, it's a new partnership. Torben Belts has got an impressive record as a coach. You felt like there was quite a good relationship there. It felt like things were starting to come together. Maybe it needs some time. And also, the other reason I perhaps felt that way is exactly as you said, David, because that's the convention. You know, it's the convention for players to have a coach and stick with them, all of that. You know, that is what most tennis players do. But just as you pointed out, Emma Raducanu has not done anything the conventional route. You know, she won the US Open before she'd played a professional match on clay. This is not someone who necessarily needs to do things just because that's the way things are done. And I think the more I think about it, I think she needs some kind of support system in place around her so that being on the tour is, you know, a nice place to be and somewhere that she can enjoy and all of that. But does she necessarily need a coach? Not necessarily. You know, she's spoken about wanting sparring partners, hasn't she? And
what an interesting line that was. You know, I'm concentrating on my sparring.
Yeah, because
I've never heard that before.
No, because she said she wants to get used to the speed of the ball a lot more on the WTA tour. And it sounds like she's identified that as a problem rather than necessarily her sort of tactical approach to a match, which seems to be spot on already. We've seen examples of that in her career, of how flexible and adaptable she is on court. And it sounds like even with Torben Belts, Raducanu herself was putting together a lot of the tactical plans. And honestly, this match she played today against Kostyuk, I think's the best she's played since the US Open. It felt the most US Open-like, where, just as you said, right from the first ball, it was clear she was playing well. And, you know, if we go back to the US Open, that was such a trademark. She won all those matches pretty easily. She started matches well, and this is the best I've ever seen her hit her forehand today, and I would say even better than at the US Open. It wasn't the forehand which stood out. It wasn't the forehand which stood out then. It was a lot of other things. But today, she was just bossing points with it, and I think that little bit of extra time on the ball actually helps her. She's embracing the clay, her mindset's good, her movement's good, and yeah, there's a kind of joy about her, and she was signing all the autographs like she was at the US Open after the match. And yeah, it just, in her words, she was vibing, and she vibed her way to the US Open title.
I mean, I wish I knew what that meant, but I'm way too old to know. More than twice her age, I'm sure it means something. No, I mean, basically it means, yeah, I do like that. She's just feeling away and doing it her way. So good for her. She's got Angelina Kalinina next, who beat Garbiñe Muguruza. I'm not sure I've watched a full match of Kalinina. Have you?
I saw her today against Muguruza, and she also beat Sloane Stephens. And a couple of weeks ago, she beat Rybakina in Charleston. She had a lot of big wins recently.
Blimey.
She I think she won a title last year, Budapest maybe. She won a lot of matches in the last 52 weeks. She's a solid player, but you know, and look, we should say on Raducanu, it's obviously, you know, in the same way we wouldn't judge a relationship with Torben Belts after two matches, you know, we probably shouldn't judge this sort of new route she's taking after two matches either. You know, this needs time as well as an approach, but it's a great start. And I think it just proves that she doesn't necessarily have to do things the way we would expect her to do things. She's carving out her own route, and I like that.
How much would you judge Naomi Osaka on clay at this point? She won her first round against Anastasia Potapova and seemed pretty happy with that performance. She won it comfortably. Lost today against Sara Sorribes-Tormo. Now, I know Osaka seemed to be struggling a little bit physically at the end of the match, but that didn't feel like it told the story of it to me. I haven't heard a press comment, so I don't know whether she's elaborated on whether there was a serious problem, but the main problem seemed to be her opponent and the court to me. And she doesn't slide. She does these little stutter steps into balls and then hits the living daylights out of it, like she does on hard court. And sometimes she hits spectacular winners, but my word, does she hit a lot of errors. And the ball was just coming looping down the middle of the court most of the time, and then she would miss.
Yeah, she had some strapping on her leg. She said she had a little Achilles problem, but again, she said that wasn't the reason for the defeat. How do I judge Osaka on clay? I think we've seen the problem against Sara Sorribes-Tormo today, as you've outlined, because in the first match, she beat Potapova, who is also a big hitter, and it wasn't really like a clay court match. It was just, you know, it was just two players hitting big ground strokes, and Osaka was better at it, and she'd incorporated a couple of little things. She noted that she was running round her backhand return to hit forehands on the ad side, which she said she's watched Nadal do on clay and all good clay quarters, and she's trying to bring that into her game. I think there is a willingness to improve on the clay, and I think she knows that the clay falling as it does in the middle of the season, sort of every year, it kind of disrupts her year, because she gets going on a hard court, then she has these surfaces she's not so good at, and then she has to build it back up again on a hard court. You know, ideally, she would like to be smoother throughout the season, I think. And so that was fine in the first match against Potapova, and I actually thought the Madrid conditions, the altitude, might suit her, because we've seen big hitters win Madrid before, but Sorribes-Tormo was just a complete nightmare for her today, mixing up the spins, mixing up the pace, mixing up the ball trajectory, moving Osaka about. And as you said, she gets in position with these steps and doesn't get in position, basically, and then still tries to hit huge winners and ends up mainly overhitting and missing by big, big margins. And it doesn't look like that's a problem that's easily solved. You know, we've seen Osaka play that way on clay throughout her career, really. She's not a clay courter, and it's going to take time. And, you know, if you keep running into someone like Sara Sorribes-Tormo, who's gutsy and who is, you know, knows her way around a tennis court, let alone a clay court, you're not going to get that time, because you're going to lose at the moment in the way her game is compared to someone like Sorribes-Tormo on this surface. So I think we've not, you know, we're kind of in the same place as we were really in about 2019 with Osaka on clay. She'll beat certain players, but as soon as she comes up against someone who knows a little bit more on the surface, I'm not backing her.
No. And if it's not happening on this one, I kind of feel less confident about her prospects in Rome, for instance.
Yeah, I think so. But I think she's trying, and I like that. I really like that. She's not just writing it off.
I'm sure it's an oversimplification, but if I were her, I'd be giving Maria Sharapova a call and asking how she figured it out, because nobody looked less comfortable on a clay court than Sharapova early on, and she won the thing twice. And just learned how to slide. I think Maria Carrillo told us that she had a sort of sliding board that she would use in the gym, you know, to teach her how to do it. which is just fascinating, and I'm sure something that my son would love to have a go at because he loves sliding on his knees to do fake celebrations of goals. Anyway, Osaka beaten, but even with all the losses of players, it's still bubbling up very nicely, the women's draw. The men's draw is just getting going, really. I mean, Catherine's told you that the main matches that we saw today. Should also mention that Andy Murray's drawn Dominic Thiem, which suddenly feels like a really nostalgic match.
It does, doesn't it? Is that a good draw for both players? Could you make that case?
Oh, I would say it's a good draw for Murray.
Okay.
Personally. Because teams, I just think he's the sort of player who's going to be rusty for quite a while, is my feeling. And then suddenly it'll click into gear and then watch out, everybody.
Yes, I hope that's the
case. But then I suppose
case.
Murray's, you know, he wasn't even meant to be playing on clay, was he, Murray?
Exactly, and he's not had many wins this season, and he wasn't planning on playing on clay. I mean, when was Murray's last match on clay? You know, it's been a while.
Who are you picking? Who are you picking? It's tomorrow night as we speak to you right now. Who are you going for, Murray or Thiem?
I think I'm probably picking Murray.
Yeah, me too. It's a nice hospital pass from me, that, isn't it?
But purely because Thiem, as you said, looks very, very rusty still. I think his forehand looks way off where it could, you know, hopefully can still get to.
Mm. This draw has thrown up some absolute belters. In the same half, you've got Rafael Nadal, Carlos Alcaraz, and Novak Djokovic.
Madness.
I couldn't believe that. It had kind of slipped my attention that Nadal is seeded 3, and it's actually Zverev at the bottom of the draw, isn't it? So that is an intriguing element to all this, that Nadal could end up in a bit of the draw of these tournaments that is not somebody you want to be playing before the final, or at all, really, but, you know.
Yes, I mean, I do remember a couple of weeks ago getting very, very excited about the prospect of Alcaraz, Djokovic in Monte Carlo, and neither of them managed to win their first match in the tournament. And
oh yeah, I'm doing it again.
But I can't not get excited by that draw. You know, the
why shouldn't we?
Exactly. Quite. I mean, I'm not going to apologize for getting excited about something. I think Nadal gave some interesting quotes today in his press conference, his pre-tournament press conference, saying he's completely recovered from the injury that he had, and actually, it was a more sort of mentally easier injury to accept, I think, than what he's had to deal with recently with his foot, because he just knew it was a few weeks on the sidelines and then he'd be fine. But the problem is, he wasn't able to train at all when he had the injury, and he said it was even difficult to sleep, you know, because it was causing him pain, those cracked ribs. So it sounds like he hasn't actually been playing tennis for that long. I think only a couple of weeks, and the first few days of that were very, very light. So I'm interested to see Nadal this week, because the last few clay court seasons he's had, he's built up, you know, and that's with decent fitness. He's built up and looked good by the, you know, middle portion of the French Open. And of course, he won the French Open in 2020. But it's not just been like the Nadal of old that got on the clay and just started winning everything straight away. So I probably wouldn't be picking Nadal for this tournament in Madrid. And I think his first match could even be Kecmanovic, which would be very tough, someone in great form. And he doesn't tend to love the conditions in Madrid anyway. But he probably needs some matches, because, you know, it's only Madrid and Rome before the French Open. So if he probably wants to get a couple of matches under his belt, at least, I would have thought. But, you know, Alcaraz and Djokovic in there as well. It's an amazing section of the draw.
Yeah, let's hope some of these matches come off. We will have another show on, well, Wednesday or Thursday, not exactly sure when yet, but we'll bring you up to date with where we are in the draw and have a good old chat. Maybe Catherine will be able to join us. If not, it'll be another voice note from her. But yes, we'll be talking Madrid again later in the week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Now, there have been other tournaments going on over the past week, and I do find this all a bit confusing. When Madrid started with the women on Thursday and Estoril was only halfway through, I was getting very confused as I was trying to watch these matches. But I actually really enjoyed Estoril, the tournament.
Great
there.
Tournament.
Particularly the run of... I mean, I've been to it. I think it used to be held in a different location when I went there some 20-odd years ago. But lovely tournament, great organisers, really... It's one of those tournaments that punches above its weight. Mm. It's got people working for it. They're very ambitious. They really want to make it something special. They really take huge pride in it. And they had a good field. I mean, you know, they had some good players there. And the match that Francis Tiafoe played against Seb Korda a couple of nights ago was just electric, because Korda played throughout the week out of his mind. Well, I mean, he thrashed Felix Auger-Aliassime, I saw, and then he took that form in against Tiafoe, and I'm embarrassed to say I switched it off halfway through the second set because it was so one-sided, and then Tiafoe came back and won, and he went all the way to the final.
Oh, David, you missed what Tiafoe was about this week, which was these improbable comebacks. I mean, honestly, that wasn't the only time he was in a losing position. He was a set and two love down in the first round against Lajovic. He was
really?
He was 5-2 down in the third set against Davidovic-Fokina, and then of course he was a set and 5-2, three match points down against Korda. And every time I thought he was going to lose, and every time he just kept coming back, and he seemed to really enjoy the atmosphere. I think he actually gave a quote in the week that he wished he receives that level of support in America. He feels like he's kind of better supported over here, and he's such a star when he's playing like that. The shot making, the charisma. I think there were a couple of quotes he gave. One during a match, he said, "Oh, I need a cold beer after this." He just said out loud, and he said, and he said at one point, "I need to go to the supermarket and buy some new legs." You know, he just gave these amazing quotes, and yet all the time he's backing that up with real effort and real desire to win, and it's just such a great combination. He played such high quality tennis. I thought he was a player I most enjoyed watching this week. Really, he was fantastic. And look, he didn't have anything left in the final to get today against Sebastian Baez, who's won his first career title. And it was a bit of a non-final really because of that. But yeah, it was a special week from Francis Tiafoe.
Who is Sebastian Baez? I don't think I could pick him out in a lineup, I'm sorry to say, but I want to know more.
Yeah, well, he made the Next Gen finals last year, and I think at the time we were all a bit like, yeah, who is Sebastian Baez, pretty much.
Let's have that conversation again.
I'm not sure any of us had seen him, certainly on a hard court. You know, he'd done a lot of winning on clay. Start of this year, he played Tsitsipas at the Australian Open, and they split the first two sets, both in tie breaks, and he was brilliant. You know, on a surface favouring Tsitsipas, he was really holding his own. And then I watched him in Davis Cup a few weeks ago, and he played on the same court. He made his Davis Cup debut on the same court where Juan Martín Del Potro had just retired a few days earlier, really. And it was like this, it's kind of like this symbolic moment for Argentinian tennis, you know, old guard, new guard kind of thing in the same space. And look, he's not like Del Potro at all. He's about 30 centimetres shorter, I would have thought, than Del Potro. He's much more like Diego Schwartzman style Argentine tennis, much more in that mould. He's got really quick footwork. He's got quite a big forehand. He likes a drop shot, and he's just a very good clay courter. I mean, I think he can get better on a hard court, but already he's good on clay. He's up into the top 50 now. He beat three former champions to win the title. You know, that's quite a run for a title at 250 level. And he had this cool thing going throughout the whole week where after every win, he was writing, "Why not me?" on the camera lens. And then finally today, after he won, he was able to write, "Yes, it's me." And it's just a great little sort of story to follow throughout the week.
And I think that was inspired by the man he beat in the final, Francis Tiafoe. I think you mentioned that was
yes,
an idea
that's
that
right.
had come through him, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think basically he'd heard Tiafoe say that and sort of adopted it. And I think winning your first title with Francis Tiafoe being the player you beat in the final is quite a good thing, because I think Tiafoe's going to be really happy for you. And I think there were scenes of Tiafoe, you know, spraying Baez in champagne and all that, and sort of appreciating that moment for him for what it was. It was good scenes.
That's great to hear. Another good tournament held in Munich as well. That's a tournament I don't think I went to it when it was on, but I went to it in its preparatory stages weeks before, many, many years ago, about 20 years ago. And it was when the tournament director was the late Rudi Berger, who was one of the great chair umpires of the 80s and 90s, and very sadly passed away more than 10 years ago now. But he took me on a tour of Munich and all their plans and what an impressive venue it was. And again, these tournaments that just want to punch above their weight. And I think you saw from Sebastian Baez how much it meant to him when he won that title. And I love seeing that. These tournaments that it's such a big deal to win that 250 tournament, where maybe for a big name it might not mean quite so much as it did for him. Sad that there weren't quite such joyous scenes in the final in Munich, because it ended with a retirement after a player who'd performed brilliantly all week in, I'm going to say it, as well as I possibly can, not up to Catherine's standards, but Botik van der Zandschulp had been forced to retire through breathing problems, 4-3 down in the first set.
I think you've been working on that, David. That is pretty spot on, I think.
Botik van der Zandschulp. Yeah.
Okay, that was a bit theatrical.
Okay. Oh, I like the theatrical bit. It's my favourite part about it, having a go at that. Anyway, he was beaten in the final by a man whose name we have been playing over and over on the ATP app ahead of this recording, because we're desperate to get it right. And I thought we'd nailed it, Holger Rune. But it turns out that Holger Rune doesn't pronounce the R. So it's apparently Holger Une, which has really caused me some problems. So we're going to go with Holger Une.
Yes, and calling any Danish listeners, and if anyone can help us with that and confirm that it is Une, that would be great.
Yeah. That would be most appreciated. And I actually love the fact that on the ATP site, he says his entire name, which is Holger Vitus Nodskov Une. And he beat Botik van der Zandschulp in the first set, when poor old van der Zandschulp retired with breathing problems. So, and he'd beaten earlier in the week Casper Ruud, which had annoyed Catherine immensely because she'd picked Casper Ruud to win the title in our newsletter, which you can sign up to, so that if you want to find out what results aren't going to happen, you'll be able to do that because we predicted them. And then he went and beat my pick for the title, which is Mirmir Kecmanovic. So thanks a lot, Buttick. Who did you pick, Matt, this week?
Someone else who didn't win the title. Who did I pick? Davidovich Fokina in Estoril.
I thought I was onto a good thing there, but no.
Well,
anyway, well done to Holger Unna, because, I mean, that's a good title win for him, isn't it? I mean, he's still a teenager and just 19 years of age from Denmark. And, you know, he's somebody that we seem to have spoken most about, sort of playing some nice, flashy tennis and maybe having a good set against whoever it was, maybe Novak Djokovic at the US Open last year. I can't exactly remember. And then cramping horribly and having to retire. He seems to have a real problem with that. But, you know, this is a big moment.
Yeah, it is. His first ATP title, didn't drop a set all week. He absolutely thrashed Alexander Zverev very early on in that tournament. Really just outmaneuvering him, really. Drop-shotting him all over the court. He's certainly been a guy whose name I think we've heard for a while. You know, he's a very good junior. He was sort of one of the best of his age group. But yeah, he's had these cramping problems. His social media is slightly irritating. It's all a little bit sort of overinflated ego for a guy who hadn't done a lot yet. But you know, fair play to him because he's won this title really, really impressively. And he definitely didn't benefit from the frozen ranking system over the last couple of years. I think he would be higher in the rankings had the sort of system been more normal over the last few years. But he's up into the top 60 now. And I think we're going to be seeing more of him because, yeah, it's a flashy game, as you say, but When he puts it together, I think it's a pretty dangerous game as well.
So that's the tennis for this week. And the really big story, though, has been that of the news that Boris Becker has been sentenced to 2.5 years for his failure to correctly follow the rules of his bankruptcy. And he'd been found guilty of moving money around, hiding money, basically, so that he didn't have to pay off all of his creditors as part of the bankruptcy. And he has been jailed for at least half of that 2.5 years. The other half of it will be on license and will be served in the community. But Boris Becker is currently in prison. And I don't sympathise with him because he's done wrong, but it's very sad, I feel, and that his life has come to this point. What was your reaction upon hearing that news, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, you've said it there. He's done a lot wrong. He deserves this, but it's sad that it's come to this. You know, such a legend. In the sport, someone who was so well liked for a long, long time, especially in this country. But it's been a long time coming, really, hasn't it? He's had financial problems for a long, long time, and it's caught up with him now. And you'll be able to speak on this in much more detail than I can. But you know, it seems like he lived his life, you know, a bit like the 17-year-old who won Wimbledon and thought he was indestructible, and he wasn't.
I think that's right. And I mean, the judge at the court said that he'd been humiliated, but he'd handled the entire case without humility. And I think that is probably the problem here, is that throughout this whole entire process and period of his life since retiring from tennis, which is more than 20 years ago that he retired from tennis, he feels like he's just carried on living like a world number one, like somebody who's still top of the world rankings with all that money pouring in from endorsements. I mean, he earned more than $25 million in prize money on court alone. You can double that, triple that for all the endorsements he had. I mean, it's hard to overstate how famous he was in the mid-80s when he won that Wimbledon. He reached six Wimbledon finals in 7 years. And he was an ever-present in our consciousness here in the UK because we only had four TV channels and he dominated two of them for a couple of weeks every single summer. And the way he came on the scene in 85 and he was diving all over centre court, he was knocking out established names, winning Wimbledon out of the blue and as a 17-year-old. And, you know, I can't help but feel sad to know that that person is now in jail, and it's his own fault. I'm not saying it's not. I'm not making any excuses for him, other than that degree of fame at that age, I think probably damaged him, or at least stunted his development and ability to handle everything that ended up coming his way thereafter. I don't know how I would have been able to handle life with that degree of attention all the time. I mean, to give you just a couple of examples, I always remember hearing that in Germany, if you showed anybody in the country that did a study, they reckoned that if you showed somebody the picture of Boris Becker, they would know who he was. You know, there was nobody in the country who didn't know who he was. And I can't say I was never close to him. I encountered him a lot over the last 25 years, but never found him particularly warm to people like me in the media or working behind the scenes. But then he could be also incredibly charming out of the blue, and you could see his charisma and you could see what he meant to people. And he just owned a room. He owned the court, and he was more, I think there's a lot more affection for him and a lot more of a mark that he left on the game in terms of impact than people who won a lot more than he did. He proved himself to be a really good coach, I think you'd have to say, over the 3 years he was with Novak Djokovic. So maybe there's something he can come back to when he finally comes out of prison. But, you know, it's hard to believe, really, that he's got himself in this degree of a mess, because it's not just the fame and those sort of things, because many others have managed it. And you also have to, you have to feel for the people that he let down along the way here and he owed money to. But it's really hard to fathom that Boris Becker is in a jail cell right now. The other thing that's happened over the past week is Wimbledon's annual spring press conference, which was inevitably dominated by Wimbledon's decision to ban Russian and Belarusian athletes, which was discussed on the Tennis Podcast last week. And Wimbledon explained that it was the government's decision that they were following. They were following that sort of lead and advice that they recommended and wanted events of that magnitude to follow that course of action. And since then, Novak Djokovic, and in fact before then as well, Novak Djokovic immediately came out and said that he didn't agree with the ban at all. Rafael Nadal has done the same today. And that does seem to be a theme, I would say, Matt, generally speaking, is most of the players, they don't like this. And that goes along with what the tours have said. They don't believe that Wimbledon should have done this. Obviously, we were tangled up last week trying to figure out where we stood on it, because to me, the only place I feel most comfortable being is in knowing that I really don't know what should be done. I know. I mean, I've said that I think on balance, I think Wimbledon have done the right thing, but the only thing I feel comfortable saying is that it's an impossible situation in pretty much every way.
Yeah, agreed. And I think it's in Madrid this week, if I'm not mistaken, where the tours are meeting, I believe, to talk about it and maybe to come up with some action. So obviously it's a topic which is going to stay very much at the forefront of conversation, I think, in tennis between now and Wimbledon, and we'll see if anything comes from that this week. But yeah, a lot of players have spoken out against it, and we obviously did a big deep dive on it last week, and yeah, I think that's the conclusion, really. It's it's pretty much impossible to fall down one way or the other, really. I feel still very, very torn on it.
Mm. We've had a lot of correspondence over the last week, a lot of people disagreeing with things we've said, other people agreeing, and I think that that's just inevitable, really. But we thank you for your correspondence. So that's the end of today's show. We have a mascot for the week. Who have we got, Matt?
We have the lovely Cooper. Cooper is a six-year-old pug mix owned by
Cooper's lovely.
Owned by Liz. Cooper is lovely. We're looking at a picture of Cooper, his tongue sticking out, loving life. And I love this story that Cooper...
We better send this to Catherine Sharpish.
Yes. Cooper is named after the restaurant where Liz and her husband had their first date, which I think's lovely. Aww. I love a story behind a name. And
yeah, absolutely.
Cooper's got a great one.
Cooper, thank you for being our mascot, and thank you to Liz for signing up as a friend of the Tennis Podcast at the mascot level. And if you want to be a friend of the Tennis Podcast yourself, not only does it help us produce the show year-round and do all the things that we've got planned, I'm telling you, we've got a lot planned, it's coming your way soon, but you also get access to additional podcasts. There are 9 currently brand new this year, exclusive for Friends of the Tennis Podcast, available. Things like the Juan Martin Del Potro story, the Lee Na story, my first Wimbledon, my first Australian Open. We got listener questions and answer shows that Matt, Catherine and myself have all done. So those are available to you if you sign up as a Friend of the Tennis Podcast. You can also introduce a show. You can also get a shout-out. We're going to have shout-outs in a minute. We've got mascots ourselves. We've got Darwin for myself. Hello, Darwin. We've got Carter for Catherine. We've got Gerald the Cat, who's sponsoring Matt. Billie Jean King is sponsoring Billie Jean the Dog, alongside Alana Kloss. So thank you to Billie Jean and Alana. Chris Albert Lee and Carl Weingartner are our top blokes and executive producers. And who are our shout-outs, Matt?
We have Fiona Hanstock in Gloucestershire.
All right, Fiona, Gloucestershire. That's just down the road from me.
It
not
is,
too far,
isn't
away.
It? And Fiona was introduced to the podcast by her son a few years ago, which I think is very nice.
Hey.
And she's a big fan of Tennis Relived, especially.
Oh, I love that. I love it when listeners introduce other listeners for the future.
Yes.
Pass it on.
Me too. That is
so do it.
Literally following your advice, David.
It is indeed.
We also have Darren Robertson from Sydney.
All right, Darren. I've been reading about Sydney this week, Matt, in my book by Bill Bryson, all about Australia.
Oh, Down Under.
Yeah.
Great book.
It's a cracking book.
Yes.
Loving it.
Are you going through all the Bill Brysons?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It's my way of separating myself from my telephone. And... it's amazing when you find a book as part of a massive series of other books and you're like, oh, crikey, I got all this lot
yes,
to look forward to.
Absolutely. I've done the Bill Bryson marathon. It's a great place to be in. And finally, today we have Barclay Hughes from St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh, wow. I don't know why that's just what a great name Barclay's got for a start. And I don't know, every time I hear these different places around the world, Gloucester, Sydney, and now St. Louis in Missouri. How cool is this show? It's global.
And Barclay's written us a really lovely note, which I won't read out in full. But Barclay, we've read it and thank you very much. And basically the gist is that he's a longtime tennis fan, but doesn't have friends or family who, you know, share his love for tennis. So discovering the podcast and a conversation about tennis has been big for him. So love to hear that. Thank you, Barclay.
Oh, thank you, Barclay. Well, we love having you with us. We love having you as our friend. And if you want a shout out as well, you can get one still by becoming a friend of the Tennis Podcast. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to those of you that are friends of the pod. And by the way, you might want to get yourself on our newsletter recipient list this week if you're not already, because we're about to announce a bit of news that's going to lead to prizes. So there's a little teaser.
Are we? Great.
Yeah, we are. You didn't know that, did you?
I didn't know we were about to announce it. I think I know what the news is, but I will be checking as soon as we hit stop.
Oh, excellent. All right. Okay, so there's my teaser. We will be back again in a few days in another tennis podcast. We'll be hearing from Catherine. And yeah, thanks for joining us today. We'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.